Welcome to the Logic Consortium. Today we're going to be speaking with philosopher Adam Hossein. Receiving his PhD in 2009, he's currently teaching as a fellow at the University of Chicago in a class on law and philosophy. Adam will be starting on the faculty at the University of Colorado Boulder in the fall. Professor Hossein is interested in political philosophy and ethics, and amongst many other things, and is going to be speaking with us today about both of these issues. First, we're going to be talking about the recent Supreme Court decision about corporations and free speech rights. And then we're going to be speaking about egalitarianism and some of the different justifications given for the redistribution of wealth. So it should make for an interesting 28 minutes. So please stick around. Thanks so much for listening. So the big issue in this Supreme Court case that came down, which was about a documentary about Hillary Clinton, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's right. A fairly pejorative documentary about Hillary Clinton.
So the big issue was whether, and there were some restrictions placed on when this documentary could be aired. And so the big issue was whether or not these types of restrictions were consistent with the Constitution.
Right, right. So according to the McCain-Feingold Act of 2002, corporations were prohibited from funding an ad, you know, some publicly distributed document or video or whatever that was about a particular candidate, and within 30 days of a primary or within 60 days of a general election. So this documentary about Hillary, it was funded in part, although actually only in small part, by some corporations. And then it was going to be aired within 30 days of the primary. So under the existing law, it was prohibited.
So at the center of this case, obviously, is the extent of a corporation's First Amendment right.
That's right.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
So in the United States, what we're talking about here is not just any speech, of course. It's political speech. It's speech about Hillary Clinton, who was running to be the president of the United States. And we give especially stringent protections to political speech in the United States, so much greater than the protection we give to, say, commercial speech. And it might be worth starting out by asking why we do that. And I take it the answer that court gives and that is there in our kind of public morality is that political speech is really important because it's essential to a democracy. If we want to have a well-functioning democracy, we have to make sure that there's a really kind of vibrant public discussion about politics that precedes the vote. If we want a democracy, we can't just have, it's more to having a well-functioning democracy than just having free and fair elections. We have to have a serious public discussion about the candidates and the issues before the election as well. And protecting political speech is essential to making sure that we have that discussion. So I think what you might want to ask when you're thinking about this case is, what do we want out of that discussion? What's that discussion going to be like? Because that's sort of going to tell you, who do you want to participate in it and what sort of participation we should want, right? And so two kind of questions you could ask about that. One question is, how involved do you want individual citizens to be in that discussion? So on one kind of view, this is a view that most famously associated with Joseph Schumpeter, but also, for instance, Judge Posner here in Chicago, that on one sort of view, look, it's not really important for citizens to be too involved in that. In fact, it might even be bad for citizens to be, really involved in the public discussion. Really, citizens in a democracy should just vote, and that'll be really the limit of their role. Whereas you might think, democracy is about self-governance. It's about, the people being really involved in governing themselves. And you might say, look, what we want is not just for citizens to have a vote, but we want to make sure that they can be really involved in this public discussion that we also think is essential to democracy. So we really need to make sure that individual citizens have a really expansive opportunity to participate in that public discussion. And if you care a lot about that, you might worry about this case because, what you've got is, a bunch of corporations now able to spend as much as they like on, ads and other political broadcasts and so on. And what you're going to see is, these corporations have a lot of money. They have really deep pockets. So you might be really worried that this is going to make it really hard for individual citizens to, really participate in the public discussion. If, a corporation could come along and pretty much buy up all the ads on TV or buy up all the radio space, it's going to be really hard for the individual citizen to get involved. So that's one kind of thing you might worry about.
You're listening to the Logic Consortium and our interview with philosopher Adam Hossein. We were talking about the recent Supreme Court case of Citizens United versus the Federal Elections Commission and how it fits into one's broader vision of a democracy. This is all kind of a lead up to analyzing a corporation's First Amendment right. So please stick around. Thanks so much.
So that was one question about democracy. You know, how involved should the citizens be in a democracy? And another kind of question is, you know, if people are going to be involved, or, you know, or whoever we do think should be involved, what sort of form should that involvement take? There, you know, are a bunch of different views about that too. One kind of view is that really a democracy is just about there being a kind of fair competition for people to promote their own interests. So when you're taking part in the political process, what you do is you just ask, you know, what's good for me? And maybe you band together with other people who share your interests, or you just go it alone and try and push your own interests yourself. But basically, everybody who's taking part just kind of looks out for themselves and sees what which outcome would be best for them, and they try and push for that outcome. And democracy is just about there being some kind of fairness to that process, the kind of fairness in that competition of, you know, people vying with each other to get their own interests acted into law. But then there's another view you might have about democracy, which says, no, you know, it's essential to our idea of a democracy that we want outcomes where each citizen is treated equally, and that each citizen has to be treated with respect in the process where we come up with those decisions. And you might say, look, you know, treating other people with respect and trying to get a good outcome that treats everyone equally requires us to not just ask, you know, what's good for me, but to ask what's best for the country. So when you're thinking about, you know, who to vote for, or you're thinking about which candidate to support in the kind of public arena, or, you know, when you're thinking about some issue and which side of it to come down on, you shouldn't just ask yourself on this view, you know, what's best for me, what'll make me better off. What you should do is you should think, you know, what would be best for the country? What would serve the common good? That's what the philosophers would call it. You know, what would serve the good of the nation or the country? So you can see that's a really different view. You know, it might be that, you know, you figure out that you don't want there to be more taxes because, you know, you'll be worse off, but you might see it's better for the country if there's more taxes. Or, you know, you can see there's a lot of cases where those different views will recommend very different things. And I think that matters a lot here for this case, because we know for sure that corporations don't think about the common good when they're figuring out what to say, when they're you know, engaged in political speech. Whenever the managers of a corporation are making decisions about how to run it and spend its money and so on, they have a legal duty to just ask what's in the best interest of the shareholders. So when they're figuring out how to spend money, you know, they're making some business decision, they have to say, you know, how will this decision impact the shareholders? And similarly, when they're making a decision like for which candidates should we spend the company's money supporting, what they have to ask themselves is which candidate is likely to promote the interests of the shareholders.
So as you're kind of mentioning, it doesn't really make sense to give corporations this robust First Amendment right when what motivates their actions isn't really furthering a democracy, but rather profits for their shareholders.
Yeah, so one thing you might say is if you think that in a democracy, what people should do when they're kind of making public statements about politics is to express their view about what's in the common good or what's best for the country, then there are going to be some associations that you where you think, you know, it's good that this association is making political statements, because really the association speech is a kind of vehicle for individuals to express their views about what's best and so on. Take the ACLU or something like that. Here you got an organization where you got a bunch of people come together because they share some views about the protection of civil liberties and so on. And they get together and they, you know, they spend money so that they can promote that cause. So because they think, look, it's in the best interest of the nation that it's in the common good that we protect these liberties, quite stringently. And so there, when the ACLU makes a statement, it's putting forward a view that on behalf of its members. So you can kind of say, look, you know, when the ACLU speaks, that's a kind of means for its members to speak. It's putting forward a view that they want to be put out there, and it's a way that they can get. So the speech of the ACLU is sort of a way that its individual members can get their own views across about what's best for the country. Whereas, as I said, you know, the speech of corporations doesn't look like that. The managers of the corporation can't just sit down and think to themselves, you know, what do I think is best for the country, or what's in the, you know, what's in the common good? They have to just ask for themselves, you know, what will best serve the interests of the shareholders, and not just any interests of the shareholders, of course, but specifically their, you know, financial interests. So it doesn't look like you can think of the speech of a corporation as kind of furthering any individual's opportunity to express their view about politics in the way that you can say that about the ACLU or some other organization. Does that make sense?
Big time. The mentioning the ACLU, it's kind of an interesting case because they wrote a brief supporting Citizens United's ability to broadcast this documentary. And kind of the logic behind it was that they were First Amendment purists and that they support the most robust First Amendment right possible. But does this logic of being a First Amendment purist necessarily, in your opinion, extend to supporting these? I mean, we already kind of went over this, but it just seems that just because you're for the biggest First Amendment right possible, you know, that someone should never be punished for hate speech, doesn't necessarily mean that you should be for this decision.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, my understanding is that after that brief was issued and after the case was settled, there's been a lot of kind of second thoughts on behalf of a lot of ACLU members. But I think that's right that, you know, you can be the kind of person who would otherwise be thought of as being, you know, a First Amendment purist, someone who's willing to protect things like hate speech or, you know, other forms of speech that might look offensive, but still think that this was a case where it was perfectly permissible to abridge, you know, certain forms of speech. And the reason is, as I said, that, you know, you have to think a lot about where, you know, First Amendment purism, if you like, comes from. If you think, well, you know, especially about political speech, if you think it's what's really, really so important about political speech is that it's super important for individuals to be able to express their view about the common good, then you're going to say, look, that makes it really, really important to make sure that each individual has a very strong First Amendment right to speak. But it's not so clear that you need to have corporations having that right.
You're listening to the Logic Consortium and our conversation with philosopher Adam Hossein. We were just talking a little bit about the recent Supreme Court decision about corporations and free speech. And now we're going to be talking a little bit about the philosophy behind redistribution and different philosophies behind taxation and redistribution in a society. So should be interesting, so please stick around. Thanks so much. Can you give our listeners a little bit of an introduction into your thoughts on redistribution in a society?
Yeah, so what I was thinking about was, we know in the United States that the redistribution of wealth is, policies that promote the redistribution of wealth are really controversial. You know, policies like raising taxes and in order to spread income more widely, or you know, at the moment, of course, there's a lot of debate about what role the government should have in healthcare, whether the government should try and make sure that each citizen has some acceptable level of healthcare or an equal level even. Well, I mean, people haven't really been talking about equality, but that's a view that you might have. And, you know, philosophers are often a lot more egalitarian than the average American citizen is. And I was just thinking about, you know, what the best argument they can give for wanting redistribution, especially on egalitarian grounds, on the grounds that inequalities in the state are unjust or unjust unless they can be given some special justification. So we could talk about some different views you might have about why you might want redistribution.
And you've put forward what you feel are the better arguments for redistribution.
Yeah, so maybe it's worth saying that there are really a lot of different views you might have in this ballpark. So, you know, one reason for caring about redistribution has nothing to do with equality at all. It's just that you think, you know, it's really important for each individual citizen to have enough to kind of lead a basic dignified life or something like that. So you might say, look, if people don't have health care, if they don't have at least a minimal level of income, then they're just not able to lead a life of kind of basic dignity. They're not able to, you know, pursue, you know, just basic projects in their life and so on. And you might think, look, that's really unjust. So that's a reason for wanting to redistribute, just to make sure that everyone has some kind of minimal level, for thinking that there's some kind of threshold of decency. Another kind of view you might have is a utilitarian view. That's a view a lot of economists have, and fair number of lawyers or law professors anyway. The utilitarian view is that basically what the government ought to do, and indeed what everybody ought to do, is to try and promote the maximum amount of happiness in the world. So when you're looking at a bunch of different policies, you add up the amount of happiness that would be produced if you pick the one policy, and then you add up the amount of happiness that would be produced if you pick the other, and then you choose the policy that produces the greatest amount. And now, utilitarianism, as I've said, you know, really focuses on the maximum. It doesn't really there's nothing in the theory that says it's better to kind of have the happiness spread around a little more evenly or something like that. But all the same, even if you have that view, there are reasons to distribute wealth itself a little more evenly. And basically the idea is, look, imagine you got two people, one of them is really rich and one of them is kind of poor, and you're figuring out, you have some money and you're trying to figure out who to give it to. And basically the idea is that the poor person is going to get a lot more happiness out of the money than the rich person. So you got Bill Gates, he's got a ton of money, we give him $1,000. Okay, it's like he barely notices it. He barely notices that you even gave it to him. You know, he's finding problems figuring out what to do with the extra $1,000, right? Whereas, you know, you go out on the street and you give the $1,000 to some guy who's earning, you know, $20,000 a year. This makes a huge difference to his life, right? It really, really improves the quality of his life. It makes him a lot happier than he would otherwise have been. So if you think that, then, you know, just for the sake of maximizing happiness, there are good reasons to spread the wealth around a little bit more, because the people who are poorer are going to you get kind of more bang for your buck when you give money to someone who's got less than to someone who's got more. But what I was talking about were views that would say there are even stronger reasons for wanting more equal distributions of wealth, or at least more equal distributions of wealth, where having a less equal one wouldn't benefit the least well off people. And there are a couple of different views you might have about that I talked about. One view is that it's just unfair when one person has less than somebody else through no fault of their own. So, you know, if we both started off with the same stuff and I went out and I gambled mine away and, you know, you saved yours and or, you know, I just set fire to mine like a crazy person, then, you know, it's not unfair that I have less than you. But if I have less than you and it's not my fault, you know, if I just happen to have poorer parents than you, or you know, I was just born less able than you, and you were born smarter or something like that, or I was born in a richer country or whatever, then it is unfair. It's like, look, you know, it's not my fault that I have less. You know, why should I accept having less than you? That's the kind of idea. But there's another kind of idea about equality, which doesn't say that it's just unfair for one guy to have less than another. It's that it's something to do with the state. And the idea is that the state has to treat people equally. So, for instance, suppose that in Chicago, people on the south side were getting less good police protection than people on the north side. When you call 911 on the north side, it takes, you know, 5 minutes for the police to come. And you call 911 on the south side, and it takes half an hour. And this comes out in the news, people are going to be pretty upset about it, right? They're going to say, look, this is wrong. This is unjust. And I take it what they'd have in mind is that, you know, the state's providing this service, and it better provide it equally to each person in Chicago. So there's, you know, we have this idea, at least in, you know, a liberal democracies, that it's important for the state to treat each individual citizen equally, you know, whatever race they are, wherever they live, you know, whatever religion they are, and so on. And you might think, because of that requirement that the state treated citizens equally, it's important for individual citizens to have equal shares of resources and so on.
Hello, you're listening to the Logic Consortium in our discussion with philosopher Adam Hossein. We're just discussing different justifications for redistribution of wealth, and now we're going to be talking about Adam's equal treatment view. So, Adam, something that you've put forward is that equal treatment should mean a government treating their citizens equally with respect to political goods. Can you talk about this a little bit?
Yeah. Maybe here's a way into it. Take this healthcare debate that we have right now. So some people in the United States have less good health insurance than other people. Some people don't have health insurance at all, right? I think this is unjust. And I think it's unjust in part because it means that the state's treating its citizens unequally. But people might ask, you know, what does this got to do with the state at all, right? You know, people buy the health insurance. Some people have more money than others. And, you know, the state should just stay out of it, right? And then there are a couple of things to say about that. One thing is, you know, when people say, look, in the current situation, so, you know, take the situation where the state doesn't provide any health care at all to anybody. People just buy it all in the private market. You know, some people want to say, look, that means this is fine because this is just a situation where the state stays out of health care and that's what it ought to do. But you might think, you know, that's wrong. Even in that situation, the state is actually deeply involved in affecting the distribution of health care. So, you know, the state does a bunch of stuff, even in that situation, which results in some people having more health care than others. The state creates and protects property rights. The state enforces contracts. The state makes rules about, you know, what the healthcare market's supposed to be like. And all these things the state does, and they all cost taxpayers money to do, all have, you know, large effects on who gets healthcare and who doesn't. So even in that supposedly what people call, you know, free market situation, the state's really deeply involved in what's going on. So it's not like we really have the option of getting the state out of healthcare. And then the second thing to say is, well, given that the state's going to be involved, you know, what should it be doing? And, you know, should the state care about the fact that what it's doing is resulting in unequal distributions of health? And I think the thing to say there is that, you know, we should ask, you know, what are the kind of interests that people have that the state should care about? You know, there's some things about your life that the state shouldn't have any concern about. Like, doesn't matter to the state whether you're listening to the right kind of music, or it's not an interest that the state is concerned with, or state isn't concerned with making sure that you have enough friends or something like that. But should the state be concerned with healthcare? Should the state be concerned with your interest in being healthy? And you might say, look, think about some other cases of things that we think the state ought to care about. So one thing we think the state ought to care about that we talked about already is free speech. We think it's really important that the state gives special protection to people's interests in expressing their political views and maybe in expressing other views, you know, about art or literature or whatever. And another thing that people think the state ought to care about is people's interests in religious freedom. So people think, look, individuals have this really important interest in being able to pursue the religion that they care about or they believe in. And that's another interest that the state ought to give special protection to. So, you know, we have religious exemptions in the United States and so on. So when you think about all these other things that we already think the state ought to care about, like, you know, free expression and religion and so on, you notice that doing most of those things, being, you know, speaking and pursuing a religion and so on, requires you to be healthy. If you want to attend a political rally and, you know, express your view about President Obama or, you know, whatever issue of the day, then you're going to need to not be sick in a hospital bed, right? If you want to go to your church and, you know, say your prayers and participate in the church community, you're going to need to, you know, have your broken leg fixed, right? So pretty much all these things that we think the state already ought to care about, you know, these interests that we think are what you might call political interests, you know, interests that should be the proper concern of government, they're all things which are closely bound up with health. They're interests which they're interests that are only satisfied when someone is healthy. So if you care about these other things, it looks like you ought to care about it. If you think the state ought to care about these other things, the state ought to care about healthcare too.
Focusing on some of the arguments of free marketers,
and you mentioned in the article that these people put forward these policies potentially to help because they think it helps create wealth and raise the standard of living.
Right.
And these are there's similar justifications given by free marketers in the global context, that trade between nations will help create wealth and ultimately, I think, maybe lift people out of poverty. What I'm trying to get to is that, are these free market arguments that I kind of just tried to sketch, are they consistent with what a philosopher sees as egalitarianism?
I mean, there are a lot of different ways of doing it, I think is the right answer. And you could certainly be for free trade along with some other, at least if it's accompanied with certain other policies, and still be an egalitarian. So, you know, there are a couple of things you notice about trade. One is that trade does improve the standard of living in a country, right? And that's a good reason for caring about it. And it's a reason that you can care about it if you're an egalitarian. The problem with free trade is that, you know, although it raises the overall standard of living in a country, it also often ends up imposing costs on certain individuals or groups in the short run. So, you know, we start trading with some other country. It's great, you know, we get to buy some of their cheap goods. Prices for, you know, goods that would previously have cost us more cost us less. You know, creates jobs here. We get to export things that we wouldn't have otherwise been able to. These are all good things. But, you know, there are some individuals who end up bearing certain costs, like they get laid off or whatever. And, you know, if you're an egalitarian, what you want to say is, yeah, you know, we like free trade because we care about the fact that it, you know, raises the average or, you know, increases the pie, the overall pie. But, you know, given that the state has to show equal concern for each citizen, we have to be sensitive to these costs that individuals are going to bear. We have to make sure that the people who lose out from these policies get compensated, get helped back into new jobs or whatever. So it's fine to care about free trade, but it's just important to kind of make sure that you pay attention to people who might lose out in the short term.
You're listening to the Logic Consortium and our conversation with philosopher Adam Hossein. We're going to finish up the conversation kind of talking about egalitarianism and where he sees it being manifested in today's political debate. So please stick around. Thanks so much.
You know, could you comment on, maybe to finish off, egalitarianism, maybe with some final comments, and where you see it being manifested in today's political debate?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard sometimes to pull apart in political debate people who care about what philosophers call sufficiency, which is, you know, everybody having enough, and people who care really about equality, about, you know, people having the same or the same, you know, less, having less is, can be given a special justification. So, I mean, in this healthcare debate, it might be that the people who support, you know, getting people insured and support it because they think, look, you know, if you're not insured, you're doing really badly. You're not able to lead a kind of decent life if you're constantly under threat of, you know, getting sick and, you know, not being able to do anything. But that's one reason for caring about extending health care to the uninsured. But another reason to care about it is the more egalitarian idea that you think, you know, every citizen is entitled to a similar level of health care or similar degree of health care insurance provision. It's often hard to kind of separate out those two ideas of people getting enough and people getting equal amounts.
All right, Adam, thanks so much for coming.
Thanks for having me, Jake. It was a lot of fun.
Yes.
You're listening to the Logic Consortium, and that was our interview with philosopher Adam Hossein. We were talking about everything from the recent Supreme Court decision on corporations and First Amendment rights. We're talking about different justifications for redistribution of wealth in a society, whether trade's contrary to egalitarianism. So thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.